Argument, Schobert versus Department of Transportation, Mr. Blood.
May it please the court. Mr. Hozak. My name is Curtis Blood, and I represent Gerard Schobert and Ronald Werner in this appeal from a Title VII judgment for the defense involving gender discrimination in the workplace. The defendant is obviously a unit of Illinois state government, the Department of Transportation. And our basic position here today is that this court, in the ACOR case, said...
I'm bothered by your ripple effect theory. I mean, suppose you have a workplace, you have 1,000 people in it, and one of them is a woman. There's only one woman. And the boss is biased in favor of women, so he treats her better than any of the 999 men. And you're suggesting that each of these 999 men has a Title VII claim because since she was treated better than they were, they maybe in some probabilistic sense were treated worse. She got the best jobs, so they in some unpredictable way got worse jobs. That doesn't seem... And then any complaint they make about, oh, the supervisor is favoring this woman, then becomes protected under the statute. So you have this whole, you know, second stage of retaliation suits. Do we really want to go down that road? What's really your position? Any favoritism for one employee, you deem to be adverse employment action against the others.
It's an unusual case, Your Honor.
Well, it's not going to be unusual if you win. It's going to be a precedent for zillions of cases. Because nothing is more common than to have, you know, favoritism in the workplace.
Well, what is the alternative? To say that if there's one...
The alternative is to say that you have to show an adverse employment action, so you have to show some material alteration in the working conditions of the plaintiff as a result of this favoritism. So if you had 50% women, 50% men, then you have favoritism for the women. That's quite likely to have an adverse impact on the men. But if you have a very small percentage in the favored group, then the impact on the disfavored is so diffuse that maybe we should say that just is not adverse employment action.
In that case, Your Honor, there would come a point when you say that there are so few of the favored gender that you just can't have gender favoritism.
But what's the difference in this case? Well, maybe there's a percentage game with the numbers. But in this case, there is the one woman. But why would this case be any different if the boss happened to have, you know, a brother-in-law that got all the choice job assignments, assuming all male workplace, one person is favored because they just happen to be favored. It's brother-in-law or it's, you know, a protege of some kind, some young person is being brought along. And so everybody else is doing things that are within the job description. But anyone who has any job could tell you that there's probably some internal hierarchy that the employees could identify as, you know, the good part of the job and the not so good part of the job. But you signed on to do all of them. I mean, I guess that's my problem with this. I don't see what creates the gender discrimination here, even though it does happen to be a woman who is, as it were, you know, the teacher's pet or something, the favored person.
Well, and that's why I just wrote about it in my brief. It's not intuitive, I don't think. It needs to be looked at. But our position is that just because there's only one woman, there aren't that many men either. Just because there's one woman doesn't mean that there cannot be gender discrimination in the workplace. And our position is that it happened in this case.
But why were they discriminating in her favor? Was this a personal thing or because she was a woman?
What
if she were the daughter of the boss to alter Judge Wood's?
Well, of course, like, I cannot read minds, but the record's susceptible to both views, I think, or maybe a mixture of the two. Why doesn't she have to go to a town where that's considered a more dangerous location to work in? Why doesn't she have to work up on the side?
Wouldn't it be odd to say that the boss couldn't favor his daughter because she's or son? It wouldn't matter as long as if there were people of the other sex in the workforce. Aren't we getting pretty far away from the purpose of Title VII?
Well, I can't alter the facts, Your Honor, and I believe that that just because there is one woman in the workplace does not mean that there cannot be gender discrimination, but I cannot alter those facts. That's what we have, and no matter how I argue or what I say, there's only going to be one woman.
What if this woman was the boss's daughter? And that's why she's being favored. Is that still a violation of Title VII?
And she's the only woman in the workplace.
Yes.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The motive is really... You cannot read people's minds.
It makes a lot of common sense.
You have to infer it. Well, I'd like to point out...
Does it make any sense, or is this just some inexorable implication of statutory language, or what?
Well, I think that...
My case doesn't make any sense, do you think?
The relative.
Yeah.
Well, there's another possible motive in that case, but it could be an additional motive. But nonetheless, I think you can still have gender discrimination in that case. And I don't think the statute excludes it, or that the case law does either. An unusual case. I would just like to point out, before I save time for rebuttal, though, that whatever you think of the discrimination count, the EEOC... proceeded on it, issued a right to sue, and at this point we have a systemic occurrence of harassment, even to the point where Mr. Schobert ended up on medical leave with hurt back and hands, and that's all on the record, it's all in the trial. And regardless of what you think of the discrimination, Your Honor, how do you get around the harassment? How do you get around the retaliation for both of my clients?
Well, you're not claiming that they were retaliated in non-employment respects. Nobody was sneaking off to their house and putting acid on the lawn or, you know, I mean, there's either an adverse employment action that is the retaliatory act, or I suppose hypothetically one could imagine other kinds of retaliatory acts that are non-employment related, but I don't see anything about the second type in this case, so we would have to find something about the employment that was retaliation, and I guess... You know, the finding here by the jury is that nothing bad enough happened to these fellows to constitute retaliation.
Your Honor, the jury shouldn't even have...
Retaliation is a word itself that packs in the notion of something bad happened to you.
Well, in this case, we have my clients abandoned on the road. We have them asked to falsify records. We have them barred from the office restroom.
The jury may have disbelieved some of those things, right? The jury finds...
Oh, yeah, definitely may have. They could have believed these things didn't occur. But we're saying that in ACOR, this court said that the elements of a prima facie case, like adverse employment action, don't go in the finding on whether retaliation occurred. It's simply whether retaliation occurred.
It's a definitional issue for me, because you do have to prove that retaliation occurred. Something... You got struck back against somehow. Some bad thing happened to you because of your assertion of protected rights. And it seems to me that's what the jury rejected here.
Well, what we're saying is if the jury was properly instructed, they might not have, Your Honor. And that's the nub of the case. That's why we're here. Mm-hmm. We're asking for a clear, proper instruction under this court's opinion in ACOR. I'd really like
you... Okay. Thank you, Mr. Blood. You can... Mr. Hussard?
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, and I urge the courts to affirm the district court's judgment because it did not commit an abuse of discretion in denying the plaintiff's motion for a new trial. Let me briefly address two factual assertions by opposing counsel that are not supported by the record. He claims that the evidence shows that the EEOC proceeded upon the sex discrimination claim. That evidence was admitted solely for purposes of establishing chronology, not for substantive purposes, and that is clear from the record. He also claims that there was harassment of the plaintiff to the point that he went out on medical leave. The trial court was clear that there was no evidence tying up causality between the claimed harassment and his medical leave. Efforts to try and do that were struck from the record. The record does not support the proposition that opposing counsel just asserted. Let me proceed to the basic argument. The plaintiffs have said, essentially with respect to both of their claims, that they did not need to show that something bad happened to them, that it was enough that there was some abstract retaliation or discrimination in the air, and that the jury instructions required the plaintiffs to prove too much with respect to each of these claims. With respect to the retaliation claim, both plaintiffs asserted such a claim, and they argue that the adverse employment action requirement was not necessary to prevail on their claims. It may have been required to get to the jury, but once they got to the jury, it was not necessary for them to prove that. That argument, I believe, is based upon a misreading of the ACOR decision, which deals with the proposition under the Supreme Court's decision in the Postal Service versus Aikens, which essentially says that the intent element of a prima facie case and the intermediate steps relevant to establishing intent under the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting analysis drop out. It does not say that the ultimate element of an adverse employment action on which the plaintiff always bears the burden of proof also drops out once you get to the jury.
But here's the problem. You know, these instructions, I have to say, are pretty bad. And it seems to me the jury might have been confused because on the one hand, it seems like they can't even find liability until they've found damages. And then after they've found liability, they're told you can find even a dollar, you know, worth of damages if you think it's only nominal. They may not have known how to make heads or tails out of this. And with respect, I mean, that's the problem, I think, at least one of the problems that exists with this. Because on the one hand, we can say, yes, you can read the jury instructions as a whole. We say that all the time. But if the first half of the jury instructions say A and the second half say not A, there needs to be a way that we're confident the jury resolved inconsistencies.
Well, and with respect to that issue, and I believe that focuses solely upon the claim that the plaintiffs were required to prove damages. I think on the retaliation claim, the adverse employment action element.
I don't understand that. First of all, adverse employment action doesn't actually appear in the statute, does it?
No, and I think Your Honor has indicated in the Power case that the short answer.
And if they retaliated by throwing a stone through the window of his home, why wouldn't that be actionable?
The case law defines what the adverse consequence must be, some threshold it has to meet. The court's many decisions, the Est case, the Powers case, the Hunt case,
just because
and recently the Merkel case.
Often the retaliation, though, doesn't mean that it has to be, right? There are other cases that have said non-employment type of retaliation might do. The question is what's alleged here.
Well, in this circuit, it's clear that an ultimate employment action requiring a firing or termination is not required.
It's not required.
And Merkel says that although it does often, most commonly involve some economic impact, that also is not required. But on a case-by-case analysis, the courts do say, this court has consistently said, that it has to be something bad, not just different treatment without an adverse consequence.
That's not what this judge asked the jury to find out. That's the problem. This judge focused the jury, first of all, on a burden of proving damages before you even know if there's liability, and secondly, a burden of suffering adverse employment action when that isn't the law.
Well, it is my understanding with respect to the retaliation claim that an adverse employment action element is required.
You just said it wasn't.
Just said it wasn't, though.
No, no, I said that what constitutes an adverse employment action
If you throw a stone through the person's window, that's obviously not an employment action.
There are things that can happen outside the employment context. The Runyon case that they cite originally stands for the proposition you can disparage a former employee, and that still, ultimately would seem to constitute an employment action.
But how could breaking a person's window be an employment action? That's ridiculous.
If here I am arguing the opposite side of the case, but I don't want to try and push the limits too far. Ultimately, if an employer told all the employees in the shop to go out and beat up the
Why don't you stick with the employer or Miss Roth or was that her name? Tame Roth.
Tame Roth.
Suppose she goes and throws a stone through this fellow's window because she doesn't like his having complained. So
a co-employee.
That's clearly not an employment action. That would be an absurd use of the term.
Suppose the supervisor doesn't, anybody. The point is, it's not an employment action, and yet it's retaliation for filing the claim, and you're not allowed to retaliate.
The statute does require, with respect to the discrimination clause, 2000E2, that there be a discrimination with respect to the...
We're not talking about that, though. We're talking about retaliation.
Under the retaliation section, they have borrowed to a great extent the same principles with respect to 2002.
You can't retaliate because of the person's invoking protected rights under the statute.
And it's not enough...
It doesn't say retaliation is only... discrimination in terms and conditions of employment. It never says that.
No, I appreciate that, but it's not enough for a retaliation context for the plaintiff to allege and prove that the supervisor looked at him twice.
We're not talking about that. I thought you conceded that breaking the window would be retaliation.
I don't know that I've taken a position on it. What I'm trying to address is...
Well, is it or isn't it?
I would say that if the employer did it as a conscious effort to get back at that person for having engaged in protective expression, arguably that might meet the threshold that this court has established.
But it's not an adverse employment action.
Because what, the employment-related element isn't...
Your instruction's wrong.
What's your conception? An adverse employment action is doing something in the employment setting, cutting a person's wages or making him mop the floor, whatever. But if you go to his home and break his window, that's not an employment action.
Then I'd be glad to agree with you, Your Honor.
And if it's not an employment, then Judge Wood's question is, well, doesn't this mean the jury was misinstructed?
No, there's nothing in the instructions with respect to the retaliation claim that imposes upon the plaintiffs the burden to prove something that isn't an employment-related action. They had argued against
it. Well, what did he have to prove? Damages? Is that just damages?
Well, they had a separate argument with respect to the damages requirement. Their first argument, based on ACOR, is that they didn't even have to prove.
Not argument. What is the relevant instruction about what the retaliation has to do to the victim? What does that say?
It says that they had to prove an adverse employment action,
yes,
and that they were...
Yes, but we just agreed that you don't need an adverse employment action for retaliation. So that sounds as if it's an erroneous instruction.
I'm sorry, I have not agreed with that, Your Honor, and
Well, you've been noncommittal about it.
What I'd like to represent is this court's case law has consistently said that for retaliation claims...
Do you take a position or not on the window breaking?
It's a characterization issue, I think.
Well, what's your position?
My position is, Your Honor, that if the employer does it specifically against the employee in those kinds
of circumstances...
All right,
but it's not an adverse employment
action.
That's the problem. That's where you're in trouble, because you acknowledge that the breaking the window is retaliation. It's not an adverse employment action, but apparently the jury was required to find an adverse employment action.
Right. In court instruction number 13, the second part of it, on the claim in count 2 that Gerald Schober was subjected to retaliation and so on, Second, that Shobert suffered adverse employment action, as that term is defined in these instructions. So it clearly requires it for the retaliation claim.
Yeah, absolutely, and it properly did so. There was no factual suggestion that anything happened outside the employment context that was the basis for the retaliation claim. I see that my time has expired, and unless
okay,
the Court has any
urgent
questions, I urge affirmance of the...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hudson. Mr. Blood, how much time do you have?
Time. 1 minute.
Thank you, Ron.
As I understood it, your complaint about the instruction wasn't about this adverse employment action. I thought it was about the use of the word damages instead of injury.
No, Your Honor, it never was that.
No.
Simply that these were that both damages and adverse employment action were requirements that did not belong to
liability.
What is
it, your conception of what a harm a plaintiff has to prove in a discrimination case or a retaliation case? What is the harm?
The harm that he has to prove, that it occurred, Your Honor.
Under this court's case. No harm?
Well, look at the
like a dignitary harm? That if you've been discriminated against, at least nominal damages or... Like in the Tester cases?
Well, the Kyle case, yes, Your Honor. The Kyle case, yes. And, of course, the Tim case where this court permitted punitive damages without compensatory damages, sure. Otherwise, these cases aren't going to be brought, and the whole purpose of the statute is to allow the bringing of these cases. There are other things I could
say. Well,
now,
wait, what does this mean? Does this mean that... Does this mean that if the supervisor said to Shobert or Werner, I don't like you because you're male, but didn't do anything about their employment, you know, or didn't do anything against them, that would be a violation of Title VII?
Well, just taking that strictly as you said it, Your Honor, there's no discrimination in it.
But doesn't discrimination imply doing something bad to someone? No?
Well, yes, it does. It doesn't necessarily...
So if nothing bad is done, well, but isn't that what these instructions are trying to get at? You had to show that something bad happened as a consequence. I mean, it's easier to see with the discrimination thing. Wouldn't the jury have to find that something bad happened to these guys as a result of the favoritism to the woman? Nothing bad happened to them. How were they discriminated against?
Well, in this case, under this evidence, the bad is they're the ones doing the high wire act while she's down in the truck.
Right, so you're saying something bad happened to them, and so wouldn't that be a basis for damages?
It could be, Your Honor. It would be.
Then why are you objecting to the instruction?
Because to support a finding of, or in the instructions that define what has to be done to find liability for gender discrimination, the damages has no business in it. This court said so repeatedly. Well, said so
every court. Every tort, including the statutory tort, injury is part of liability. There's no liability without injury for a tort.
The fact that, in that sense, Your Honor, the jury shouldn't have been instructed on it, but the fact that the tasks are different. In fact, there's more dangerous, less dangerous tasks, more desirable, less desirable tasks. That, in a sense, is injury, but to instruct the jury that they've got to find that sort of injury or damage in order to support a finding of liability, not damages, not a dollar sign, but liability.
But
that's
you understand there's a difference between injury and damages, and that there has to be injury in order to be there to be a tort.
That's a concept, Your Honor, not as a jury question.
Well, it's not how juries are instructed. In fact, instructed they have to find every element of the tort in order to find liability.
Well, Your Honor, we're just asking this court to keep its promise that it made to plaintiffs in ACOR, which is that we're just going to get to the ultimate question of discrimination or not, and then go on to damage.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, next case, last case for argument, United States.